And welcome to Women in Music. Today's guest is Jessica Curry, a BAFTA-nominated composer who's responsible for video game scores like the highly celebrated Dear Esther and Amnesia, A Machine for Pigs. Recently, she composed the score for Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, a revolutionary new experience in video gaming. Hello, Jessica, and thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to talk to you.
It is very nice, the wonders of technology.
I know.
Everybody's Gone to the Rapture has received an astounding amount of critical acclaim in both the gaming world and in the music world. As the joint studio head at the Chinese Room, how did you envision this game when the project first began?
Director at the Chinese Room, and he always comes up with the initial idea for the games. He is an ideas machine. He's absolutely phenomenal at coming up with really, really good concepts. And he said to me, I want to make a game that is about the end of the world. And I was like, oh, it's been done so many times. No, I can't, you know, post-apocalypse. And he said, no, I want to do something different. I want to do it from the perspective of normal people. Because he said, you always play as the hero. And he said, you wouldn't be that person. We wouldn't be that person. We'd be the people just lying there in the zombie apocalypse, you know, dead after like the first 4 seconds. He said, I want to write about real people. And I think the thing that Dan and I are always interested in is those real stories, human connections, truth, really, honesty, and just ordinariness. And that's where the interesting things lie for us.
Do you know, I know that they recently, not recently, a few years ago, made a movie of the book World War Z, and I felt like the movie was a terrible interpretation of the book, because the book focused on the normality of what something like an apocalypse or a zombie apocalypse would be, and like, you know, like the political and the capitalist movements that came in after that, and that's what I found interesting, and that just wasn't in the movie. In the movie, it was Brad Pitt's the hero.
Absolutely, I completely agree. For me, it's the least interesting perspective, and for a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, I think it's been really overdone, but I think that's what makes Everybody's Gone to the Rapture so special, that it's just this really kind of slow exposition of exploration. And obviously, I think in the past, the gaming world has really been focused on like sort of violence and beat the bad guys and first-person shooter type stuff, and for me anyway, as a gamer, I'm really liking this sort of shift to maybe more, you know, storytelling and exploration and puzzle type games. I think that that's a really interesting development.
And I think it's really changing quite quickly now, actually. I think next year there is going to be a bumper crop of games. You've got Abzu, Adrift, Firewatch, Bound has just been announced by Santa Monica, which looks really interesting. And I think there's an acknowledgement now that people are interested in those kind of games, and that we can expand what the genre is. And, you know, it's always really interesting to me when people complain on forums saying, oh, these not games, or, you know, these walking simulators, and they're so aggressive about it. And I think, but the kind of games you like still exist. We're not taking those away. We're just adding to the genre. So I'm always a little bit confused by the kind of almost panic that gamers seem to feel. The genre is expanding.
Yeah, I definitely hear you. So going back to your probably most recent project, in Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, the music obviously has like pretty clear influences from like the Anglican choral tradition. When did you decide in the process that the score needed to sound the way that it did in the end product?
That's a really good question. I'm a really slow writer. I am tortoise slow. And the good thing about being involved in the company was that I had a lot of time to experiment. So in the end, I kind of spent 2.5 years perfecting the score. And it started off really, really abstractly with bells as a kind of very, very ambient soundscape. And it was a good starting point, and it gave the team something to work off, but it wasn't right. And I knew it was set in 1984, so then I went down the, I'm going to make it sound really, really heavy synth, kind of Vangelis, Blade Runner kind of sound. And that, the music was really good, but it just jarred completely. Because the story and the game and the visuals are very timeless, and sort of imposing a very specific musical time onto the story. It just felt too heavy-handed. And a lot of people said, oh, I think that's the way you should go. And I just thought, no, I'm going to stick to my guns here. And then I sing in a choir, and the soloist was Aileen Manahan-Thomas, who is the soprano on Rapture. And I'd never heard her sing before. And she opened her mouth. I thought, by God, I have struck gold. I just thought, she is the voice of Rapture. It was a wonderful moment that you don't normally get in ordinary life. We just go, oh my God, this is it. And it was so exciting. And from that point on, the score just flowed. It sounds really improbable, but it just kind of, it was such an inspiration, that pure tone, and it kind of fell like dominoes after that. It was brilliant. But there was a lot of work that went up to that. It sounds like it was really easy. But I think whenever you are creating anything, it's just that really long process of elimination. And rather than saying it's this, you're constantly going, it's not this, it's not this, definitely not that, it might be this. And it's just this chipping away. It's almost like archaeology, I think.
That's an interesting analogy, I think, you know, sort of figuring out the ways not to do it. But like Thomas Edison and the light bulb, they say he had like 100 ways not to make a light bulb until he found the one that was correct.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned your soloist and feeling like you struck gold. What was the whole recording experience like?
Oh, it was just unbelievable. I've never experienced anything like it. It was by far the biggest scale project that I'd worked on. So it was a huge step up for me. Writing music for a game that long, writing for orchestra and choir and soloists, that was quite new for me. So it was a very, very steep learning curve. And I don't think I've ever been more terrified than the first day I got to air. I was just unbelievably nervous. I thought I was just going to either faint or be sick or just run off. That was my third option, was just leaving.
Just run away.
No, I haven't seen Jessica. No, sorry. But I steeled myself and they started playing. And I just thought, this is all going to be really fine, better than fine. The quality of the players, I think, is something that makes the music, the soundtrack stand out from some others. I just think the musicianship and the quality of intent, I think because I was so excited, I was kind of like a child. And I think they used to quite, you know, macho, I've done this a million times, composers who sit very nonchalantly in the booth. And I was just like, I'm so pleased to have you all here. It's going to be amazing. And I think it could have gone one or two ways. It could have just made them just sink into their chairs and, you know, been really embarrassed. But actually, they really went with it and said, we're going to give you the best experience that you can have, because it's obviously very new to you and very exciting. And I think you can hear when something comes together, not just in music, but in, you know, architecture or theatre, when there's this unified intent and everyone is focusing on the best thing it can, you know, making it the best thing it can be. You hear that, I think, and you recognise that. So
it's like a different feeling of energy, I think.
Yes, absolutely that. And I think it gives it a life. And that's what they did. And I will be eternally grateful to them, because they do it every day. You know, they work long days and they really liked the music. And I think the other thing that made a difference was that I had a female leader, Cleo Gould, who was the amazing solo violinist as well. And I think there was a female energy, actually, and it was very, very commented on. So it wasn't just me going, oh, I'm just in my hippie ways. It's all really soft and gentle. A lot of the players said it had a different energy to normal. It was much softer, much quieter. I didn't just push them through it all the time. I'd left enough time to actually have, you know, little discussions and get through it. And they responded to that and they were amazing. I would be eternally grateful to them.
You mentioned that this was your first time doing something of this scope. What is your background in music like?
So I'm not classically trained. I read English literature and language at university. I always loved music. It was always my passion. I did music A level from 16 to 18. Didn't have the most encouraging teacher, and he kind of put me off really. And I was very, 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 very shy teenager, and thought, well, I'm really good at English, I'll do that instead. But really missed music. Ended up working at the Warner Brothers store selling toys to rich Londoners and international visitors. And my lovely late stepdad pushed an application for the National Film and Television School, and he said, you need to be doing music. You're obsessed with films and you're obsessed with visual media. This is just bloody do it, darling. It's very posh, and just said, just do it. And I went, oh, let me get in. And I applied and I got in. So I spent 3 years at the film school doing screen music as a postgrad, and kind of reacted then against the extreme commercialism at that point. I didn't want to do Hollywood films. I didn't want to do big commercial projects. And that was very much the focus there. So went off on a weird and wonderful journey of sound art and installations, and experimental opera and digital art, and a really, what I called in my GDC talk a couple of years ago, a desperately unstrategic career. And I think one of the reasons I'm not better known is because I've darted between genres and done what interests me. I haven't just gone, I'm going to do it because it'll bring the money in, although that's obviously important, or, you know, because it'll make my name. I just want to write the music that interests me and be involved in the projects that enthuse me and that I feel passionate about. And then fell into games by accident. As I said, husband Dan, he was doing his PhD. He wasn't a game developer. He was an academic. And he said, I want to experiment with how little gameplay people will actually tolerate in a game. And he went, why am I writing about it? I'm just going to make a little experimental game, which ended up being Dear Esther, which ended up changing our lives and put us on a completely different path.
So
that was a really long answer. I'm so sorry.
No, it's good. It's good.
Awake.
It's good.
Snooze during that.
I don't know if you have read it or seen it around, but Winifred Phillips, who's done music for like Little Big Planet and God of War and stuff, she wrote a book about a year or two ago about the process of writing music for games. And in it, she talks about how you don't have to go to video game music school in order to do it. Would you like agree with that, or would you say that it's a helpful thing in the process of becoming a video games composer?
That's a really interesting question, actually. I have read her book. It's by my bedside, and I would recommend anyone who's interested in writing music for video games read it. It's really, sounds like it's going to be really dry, but it's not. It's really funny, and really, she's got a really good conversational tone, I think.
It's very down to earth, I think, and it's
It's really easy read, isn't it?
Yeah.
She breaks things down really sensibly as well. I am quite a believer in, it sounds strange, almost non-specialism. I think if I'd known more about video games before I'd written the soundtrack for Dear Esther, it would have been a completely different thing. And actually what people responded to with Esther was the fact it didn't sound like anything else. And that was by dint of me not really knowing what I was doing, which has its advantages and of course its disadvantages, but I think it can give people interesting perspectives. And I think once I'd done that, I was really interested in how to be a game composer, not just a composer. And I'm gradually learning my craft, but I'm still very, very pleased that I came from somewhere else. And it's interesting when you talk to game developers in general, because it is a relatively new, I mean, not new, I mean, it's 40 years old now, but, you know, in terms of other artistic mediums, it is new. People do come from other places. You get a lot of people from architecture and theatre. Dan was an academic. We've got lots of people at the Chinese Room that have done other things. And I think it makes for more interesting experiences. So, of course, there are advantages to knowing absolutely what you're doing, but sometimes I think winging it can just give you a little different edge.
It's an interesting perspective. I think I think it's difficult for somebody who's a new composer, a young composer, or emerging. You don't have to be young to be emerging. but that you sort of get told this idea from a lot of different places that are starting to offer courses for video game composing, that they're like, you have to have this course. And so I think it's hard to sort of figure out which direction's going to be. Obviously, different people are good. Some people need the rigid structure of a, you know, of a classroom or whatever, but I think other people might be better suited to independent study, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it also depends on the career that you want. I think for AAA games, there's a certain skill set that they would expect you to have. And on a different level, if you're doing a very small indie game, you'll probably be doing everything. So, for example, I worked with Adam Hay, our sound designer at the Chinese Room, and he did a lot of the technical implementation. Now, if you're working on a no-budget game, you're not probably going to have that person, so you're going to need those skills. So what I would say is that it's very, very useful to have quite a deep technical understanding of how games work. And also, what I have found actually about now I'm more involved is that I play a lot of games, and actually I don't play them ever, pretty much for pleasure. I'd rather be doing lots of other things. I'm an avid reader and would normally rather be reading or listening to music. But when I do play them, it is really useful to have the understanding of interactivity, of the way games lead you through a space. So that, rather than study, I necessarily, as kind of specific course, I would say just play a lot of games and talk to people who are passionate about the medium as well. You learn a lot from them as well.
It's very good advice, I think. You've been vocal about it on Twitter in the past, but I would like to talk a bit more about how the score for Everybody's Gone to the Rapture got pulled from the UK classical music chart. For those who don't know, the score reached number 8 and likely would have reached number 1, but it was moved to the soundtrack chart, where it faced competition from heavy-hitting scores like Frozen, you know, the Disney movie Frozen. Do you think that this was an act of music elitism?
See, it's so interesting, because the first thing that I said was, I can really understand why they've pulled it, because soundtrack sales would likely decimate classical sales, and, you know, they don't want the competition. And then people started saying to me, but you're basically saying that what the work that you're doing isn't as good and can't be considered to be classical music, and Rapture is a classical score. And if Rapture is outselling other classical albums, that's not your problem or your responsibility. And I kind of then started to go, oh yeah, I think you might be right. And I do think there is an immense amount of snobbery about game music in particular. And I think film music have kind of, they've won the battle to a great extent. And I think we're going through the same struggle now. I'm currently locked in a little, battle is the wrong word, but I don't know what the word is, but Basker have music awards for every other genre of music apart from game awards, especially at the Ivor Novello's. And they did have a game music category and they've pulled it. And I think it's a great shame. So I'm in talks with them at the moment to say, this is a really important big industry and there's some really, really wonderful stuff going on. And if you can have liturgical music and modern jazz and music for television and film and everything you can imagine, sound art, why is it that you won't put game music into your categories? And I have to say, I think had a very satisfactory answer from them. I do think to a certain extent it comes down to not feeling it's a legitimate cultural form. And I think we've got a long way to go. And so I'm slowly, quietly having these, I don't want to call them battles because I don't want it to be confrontational, but kind of reasoned discussions, shall we say, to kind of, it's boring to have to convince people. Like, it's time consuming. And I think, come on, get with it. And Basker said, can you integrate games into it? Like the Grammys have done, it's visual media now. It isn't just film. And they said, oh, well, it's been this category for 40 years. And I thought, well, yeah, but times change. Things move on.
Tradition isn't necessarily a good thing.
No, not always. It's, you know, time to embrace change. So I don't think I'm going to win, but hopefully we'll slowly get there. And just hopefully the quality of the work will eventually speak for itself.
Well, I find it interesting that, you know, you said that film has largely won that battle already. And I think that that's, you can see that in the fact that on the classical music chart that your score got pulled from, things like Hans Zimmer compilations and instrumental Harry Potter tracks are still on the classical music chart.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah, and it does seem a bit strange and hypocritical that they would allow things like film music, which, of course, there's lots of interesting, cool things happening in film music, but there's also lots of cool, interesting things happening in game music. Even if you just look at the scope of the score for, like, Skyrim, or I wrote a review yesterday on the Fallout 4 score.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah.
You know, if you look at things like that, the immense hours of music composed, like, that's two symphonies. Two very long symphonies that you're composing music for, like, of course that's worthy of recognition. And like, how do you think that we should categorize music in the future to sort of avoid that kind of conflict? Would it be your kind of idea of just saying visual media instead of just film or just video games?
I do, but then it's interesting, you know, the Grammys have just been announced. Obviously, I really hoped for a nomination for Rapture. I didn't get one. And the five visual media nominations, they were all films. And I thought, so you've changed the... I'm not saying Rapture, you know, it had to be Rapture, but there were no game scores in there. And I kind of think, so you've changed the title, but actually it's the barrier to entry is probably still almost impossibly high at the moment. And I kind of wonder if they felt they'd done it with Austin, with Journey. You know, that was it, they'd done there. Nodded towards that now, so we don't have to do it for another few years, or if they genuinely just didn't feel there's been anything in the last couple of years that has been worthy of nomination. But I have to say, this sounds probably, I looked at Sony entered me for five categories and I counted up the nominees, and 40 were men and 4 were women. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really hard not to get a little bit suspicious. You know, we've just had the Game Awards where there was one female judge out of 52 judges.
Oh my God.
And I'm just getting, to be honest, a little bit sick of it.
It's getting embarrassing at this point. Like, every major study that's been done says that there's more adult female gamers than teenage boy gamers, which were previously, you know, the stereotype of a gamer. Like, there's more of us than there are of them, and yet they are the ones that are still being represented, not only as protagonists in games, but, like you said, as judges for, you know, and nomination and boards. Like, it's, you know, one woman and 52 men. Like, that's embarrassing. I feel like that's not even, oh, well, we're going to sort of make an effort. That's not even the bare minimum.
Well, Dan and I have started asking now, when we're asked to be on a judging panel or in a, you know, on an interview panel, we say, what is the makeup? Not just in terms of gender, but of ethnic diversity as well. Mm. Because we're both sick of seeing middle-aged white men surrounding us. And Dan said, I feel really sorry for Dan, because he said, I am a middle-aged white man, I am part of the problem. But he's been really amazing. He's given up a lot of talks recently and he's suggested someone else.
Well, I mean, that's him using kind of his position for good. Like, that's, you know, that's what they should all be doing, really.
Absolutely.
All of them that are at least slightly self-aware.
Yes.
Should be saying, my voice doesn't need to be another one echoing the same things that the other 52 men on the judging board are giving. You know, that maybe we should make room for somebody who has a different perspective and a different outlook on life. You know, and I'm sure, as you know, only 6 women have won the Pulitzer Prize for Music since 1943.
Oh, don't tell me that.
And I remember it was like a couple of years ago in April. So it was like almost 2 years ago when they had announced the Pulitzer Prize winner in 2013, I guess. or no, it was 2014. And I tweeted about it, and immediately, I had somebody who doesn't follow me, I have no idea how they found me, trolling through Twitter, I guess, who said, well, I don't think that you can say that that's definitely sexism. I think that you need to look at nominations. And I said, good, let's look at nominations. Mm-hmm. And so I went through and I spent about like an hour and a half going through like all of the nominees since 1943 and counted up. And I don't have the number sitting in front of me, but it was something like 20 women had been nominated versus like 150 men or something. And I was like, all right, here's the nominations. What do you think now? And it's just, and I mean, if you consider that and the fact that only 3 women have won Oscars in the scoring in the film score category since 1934, it's like, have we really made that much progress? Like, we're starting to sort of be like, well, I guess women are people, and I guess they can write music, but we're not going to acknowledge them. There's still articles cropping up on the internet all the time saying, well, I didn't like Clara Schumann. Women composers just aren't as good. And I feel bad for Clara Schumann because she's always the one that gets called out. Always. It's always Clara Schumann. I can't help but think it's because that's the only woman composer they know.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's only because she was married to Robert Schumann that anyone knows who she is. Nobody wants to talk about Jennifer Higdon. Nobody wants to talk about anybody else except Clara Schumann.
Yeah. Maligned. No, it is. It's frustrating. And I just think I don't want to have to talk about it all the time, but you feel so responsible for pushing this agenda, but you make yourself a target. There's no doubt about that.
Definitely.
And it's interesting, when I wrote my blog post about leaving the Chinese Room as studio head, I got so many, in quotes, reasonable men saying the games industry isn't sexist. You've got to understand, and really sort of mansplaining how I just completely misunderstood. It was just being oversensitive. And this is kind of what worries me, is that people always talk about Gamergate and they talk about extremism, you know, that kind of misogynist, very openly anti-women agenda. And actually, they're not the people that worry me. The people that worry me are the people that I interact with every day who don't think that they are at all sexist. But there's just little things that they say, and I just think you need to be more self-aware. And people don't want to admit that they are part of the problem. And I'm part of the problem in other ways. But we have to be aware of that. And just to be a little bit humble about that and say, what can we do to change it? Even if they're little direct actions that can make someone else's day or life a little bit easier. And I just think we're all a little bit complacent, not just in the games industry, just in general. So
yeah, I think that a lot of times it's kind of this knee-jerk reaction that people that are in places of privilege don't want to admit that they got to where they are because of their privilege. They want to think, oh, well, I got here solely off on the hard work off my own back. And you think, well, you know, yeah, you did work hard and you did put in a lot of effort, but the reason that you got recognition and opportunities is perhaps not because of solely that, but because you're more likely to be visible because of, you know, what gender you are, what skin color you have, you know, so on and so forth.
I completely agree. I mean, I was, again, at my GDC talk, I said at the end of it, some of the people that I know that are really successful now aren't the most talented people. They are the people that had the resources to have the privilege not to give up. And I know a hell of a lot of really talented artists, composers, all kinds of people who simply couldn't afford to keep going. They couldn't afford to push through. And I was in the, as I said earlier, very fortunate position to come from a very supportive family who said, we really want you to do this and you help me through it. Now, if you don't have that, you're at a massive disadvantage and you don't have the resources to carry on. So you have to acknowledge that actually a lot of the people I know came from very loving middle-class backgrounds, and that's just a fact.
Well, I think that's one thing that's frustrating for me anyway, as somebody who's still, you know, relatively young composer in terms of, you know, been out of university a few years, etc., is the fact that all of these opportunities that are presented as great for young composers, great for emerging composers, you know, you have competitions that have hefty entrance fees, you have... Yep. you have residencies that are incredibly expensive and offer no form of scholarships or grants or help in any way. You have workshops that are, you know, £500 for half a day of workshopping. And I understand why there's costs behind these things. There's venues, there's, you know, paying the people involved, there's paying an accompanist, you know, other musicians. I understand why there's costs involved. And of course, there's a much wider discussion to be had about cuts in arts funding and why there's no money to be had, you know, due to an austerity culture. But it is very frustrating that I think in some cases, musicians don't go out of their way to help other musicians. There's kind of this weird closed off approach in some cases. I've met a lot of musicians who aren't like that at all and who are very enthusiastic about sharing resources and sharing help and, you know, oh, well, if you record some of my music, I'll help you record some of yours. But I think there is still kind of this weird elitist barrier that's very hard to get over. And that barrier is what closes off things like awards and recognition and big productions and that sort of thing. And that's a very hard barrier to sort of vault over if you don't have, you know, somebody essentially paying your way so that you can write full time or even write part time. I mean, it's very difficult to write big pieces of music or even hone your craft when you're already having to work 40 plus hours a week to just, you know, keep the lights on essentially.
I have a lot of respect. I don't know if you read John Sharp, who was the co-chair of Indiecade, and he stepped down this year, and he wrote exactly about this in his blog post about how it's sort of, how do we help these people that need tangible support? And it's all very well saying you get exposure at Indiecade, but if you can't afford to make the game in the first place or to go there to set, you know, to promote your game when you're there, it's not actually very helpful. So people, I think influential people, are starting to ask this question. So hopefully things will gradually change. And I know there are environment artist Alex, who is wonderful, Alex Graham, who works at the Chinese Room. She's in the process of applying for some grants to go to GDC. And so hopefully those things are kind of slowly emerging.
It's a slow process to be sure. Sort of changing gears a little bit. You mentioned on your blog that you have an autoimmune disease that affects your creative process. What advice would you have for other creatives who maybe struggle with chronic illness or mental illness and how to sort of keep the creative juices flowing when you're dealing with that?
I think that anything that you go through in your life, whether it be an illness or looking after a relative or losing someone in your life or going through a breakup, all those things feed so directly into your art and your craft. And I think the rapture score for me was I'd lost my stepdad, who I was incredibly close to, and I was really quite poorly. I was quite ill for a lot of the time that I was writing Rapture. And I think one of the reasons that people have responded so viscerally to the score is that they can hear that. And they don't know what it is, obviously. It's not like, yes, I feel a lot, you know, a distinct loss in this soundtrack, but they hear something real. And I think that's the only advice I can give to people is, I feel lucky to have such an amazing place to put my fears, my anxieties, my joy, my excitement. Music is such, for me, the perfect place. It's the perfect conduit to feed all those emotions into. And I've said it before, but I genuinely feel if I didn't write music, I would probably be insane. And I don't mean that on a kind of particularly light level. I really think it would be a form of madness for me not to be able to write. I put so much of myself into my music, and I think that's what we respond to when we hear things that touch us or see things or read things. It's because it's come from a real place.
Yeah, I think that that's probably standard for most creatives to say, well, I'm going to use this and I'm going to try and I think it's almost a coping technique to say, oh, well, I'm going to try and make something beautiful with this horrible internal storm that I have, that I want to put it somewhere and be like, well, at least it did this, you know, so that maybe it's not quite so crushing if something amazing can come out of it and you can maybe touch other people and make them be able to cope with whatever they are dealing with on a different level.
It's interesting though, because I speak to a lot of people who don't put anything of themselves into it. You know, a lot of commercial writers especially are so broken. I've really heard a lot of this recently where they go, the director actually just wants to write his own thing. He just wants me to, you know, be his kind of person that can get it out onto the page, and they change it all the time and they're very, very closed off. So I think it is quite a gift to be able to give something of yourself, actually, because it makes you really vulnerable. And I think that's the thing that's hard to keep after you've done it for a long time, especially if you're writing commercially.
Well, I think commercially, like, because things get changed all the time, that maybe, like, you sort of have to close off so that you don't take it quite so personally.
Absolutely. But, I think that would be another form of madness. And I think people do kind of burn out, actually.
Oh, definitely.
I'm in my 40s now. I'm getting to the age where people are just going, I cannot do this anymore. I'm done. And they're walking away because they're just so fed up of it. So I think, yeah.
I wrote recently on Musically Notable on my blog about being a creative while you're dealing with sort of, you know, things in your life, whatever it may be, and how perhaps we should all be more brutally honest with each other and say, you know, this is what I had to go through to produce this thing, this work of art, whether it's a painting or a piece of music or a play or a dance or whatever. And because I think sometimes there's sort of this, not to be pejorative, but like Instagram culture, with people are sort of presenting these very edited versions of their lives, which is fine. There's a lot of argument to be said that, you know, presenting an edited form of your life is saying, well, I want to celebrate the good things, which, you know, of course. But I think sometimes it can lead to this sort of feeling when you're not experiencing any success, or, you know, when you're facing a lot of rejection or just non-recognition, and then you see people that are, you know, your similar age and social group and things experiencing huge amounts of success, that it's hard not to become this sort of green-eyed monster and just feel very jealous. And that maybe if we were all a bit more honest to say, well, I worked on this piece and I was recognized for it, but I also wrote 30 other pieces before this that I thought were just as good and nobody gave them a second glance.
It's such a double-edged sword, social media. I love it and I hate it. Like you say, that Instagram culture, I feel inadequate before 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, I've now unfollowed them. I started following all these, you know, mothers who still look great in their 40s. And I just think, oh, I'm just such a mess. I'm just such a mess. And yeah, we're presenting these idealized forms of ourselves. And we all know it's rubbish, but we kind of still want it as well. And like you say, it's so hard not to feel overwhelmed by other people's success or awards or recognition. But it also does the other thing, like you say, it's really good because you can connect with people who maybe do feel disenfranchised, or, you know, just people. There's people that I talk to really regularly on Twitter that I've never met, and I think that's really extraordinary. I don't really know them, but they're my social media. I know them really well in one respect. So yeah, I have a very ambivalent relationship towards it. And it's nice for me though, because it's been such a forum for people to be able to get in touch with me to tell me what my music means to them. And that's always makes my day. And I'm increasingly, this sounds really Pollyanna-ish and very Miss Worldy, but the awards are really nice and they are really lovely to get. But actually, the people that write in and say, you've spoken to me, I increasingly cannot replace that feeling, to feel that you've connected with somebody, because I have those people that I have in my life, those composers and those authors that I really look up to. And I just think, how amazing that I am that for somebody else. That's still really hard to get my head around, but social media means that they can get in touch and just give me a wave, and that's really lovely.
Yeah, I think for a lot of maybe non-commercial creatives anyway, that sort of that knowledge that you are that for somebody else is probably its greatest reward, more so than maybe the, you know, the awards and stuff, is knowing that you've made a difference in somebody's life, that you're not just throwing things into the ether, that it's actually landed somewhere along the way and done something for someone.
And it's wonderful. It's not even about feeding the ego. It's about, it's so hard to explain what it's like. I'm sure you've had it as well, but it's just when someone writes and says, you are a part of my life now. Your soundtrack is embedded in a small way in my life. And that is just really extraordinary. Because like I say, I have those pieces of music that are absolutely fundamental to who I am. And it's just such a joy to know that that's the case for other people.
I think that sort of sense of accomplishment probably, for me anyway, comes from like the knowledge that I've made the world maybe a very slightly better place, especially in these, you know, recent times of lots of upheaval and people being unsure about things and rhetoric and 24-hour news cycles, that you can make just a small change to maybe make a difference in one person's life. You know, I don't have the kind of scope to make the difference worldwide. I mean, I don't know that anyone does really, but but it's making small differences. I wrote an article for Polonius Music last week about the small things that we can do musically, you know, to sort of make a difference. Things like, you know, teaching doesn't have to be in front of a classroom or giving private lessons. Teaching can be, you know, showing a friend a new piece of music that you really like and saying, this is why I like this. And just connecting with people on a different level that's much more positive and creatively driven rather than focusing on our differences.
I think increasingly, I just feel like that's all we have. That's what Rapture was about. It was about small human connections, moments of connection. And I was, like I said earlier, I sing in a choir. I had my rehearsal last night. We're doing a Christmas concert on Saturday, and I looked around, I thought, we're such a disparate bunch of misfits and different people and different political agendas and different jobs. But that unity that comes from musicianship, it doesn't have to be a choir. I mean, the choir for me is particularly resonant because it's the voice. And I think that's something very, very powerful about not even having the filter of an instrument. But when we play together, it's an act of listening and respect and connection and beauty. And that's all we can put out into the world. And it doesn't matter if one person listens and appreciates it, or 100 or 1,000 or however many. It's that moment, I think, of playing together and being together. It's all we have.
And sort of bringing things full circle, I suppose. But I think that's what resonated with people with Rapture, was the sort of the human experience, you know, not the fantastical hero experience, but just the real true human experience of, this is what most of us are on a day-to-day basis. You know, you don't have to be from a small village in the British Isles to relate to what happens in Rapture and the storylines. Like, those are very just human experience storylines of family members who are estranged and people not being accepted in a group, whether it's a town or a social group or a workplace, or, you know, and relationships that come together, relationships that break apart. Those are just human experiences. And I really do think that's what resonated with people and what made it such a powerful game in terms of gaming experience and storytelling.
Thank you. That's so appreciated. It was a joy to work on. I don't think I'll ever work on a game that is so fitted for Jessica Curry's interests, passions and desires. It was a hard time, but it was a special time with the team, and I don't regret a minute of the time I spent on it. And I'm just so, yeah, we're all so pleased and grateful that people have had the reaction that they've had.
You mentioned relatively recently that you'll be leaving your position with the Chinese Room. What's next for Jessica Curry? What's next on the agenda?
Yeah, I kind of jumped off the edge of the cliff on that one, didn't I? I was like, oh, maybe, did I mean that? I wrote it and then I followed on it now. So yeah, I'm still a company director, but I'm not studio head at the Chinese Room anymore. And I've thrown myself straight into my first musical commission, which is choir and brass band. And it's with poet laureate Caroline Duffy, who is the most extraordinary writer. She really is something else. And it's based around commemoration for the First World War. But she's very cleverly interwoven it with what's going on at the moment. It is wonderful and terrifying in equal measures to try and live up to her amazing words that she's provided for me. And that will be premiering next year on the 16th of July at Durham Cathedral, and then it's touring. I've also just been accepted onto a film and music lab that PRSF and the British Council are running, and that's a week of a bunch of composers and a bunch of filmmakers getting together and seeing what comes out of that week and collaborating. So more music, which is so exciting because running the company took so much of my time up, and actually what I love doing is writing music.
All right, well, we'll all have to keep our eyes and ears peeled for those new projects that you'll have coming up in 2016.
Thank you.
And I think we'll call that a podcast. And for those of you who've been listening, thank you for having a listen and for having an interest, of course, in the Women in Music podcast. As always, my name's Angelina. I'm your host. And that's it for this time. And stay tuned for our next interview, which should be up in the next month or so. Thanks and have a good one.